afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And, yep, Bill Cundiff's not here. He is selling tractors down at the fairgrounds in the rain, alone. He just sent me a picture of the fairgrounds. It's like, oh.
He's lonesome Bill today.
It's just Bill and the tractors in the rain. So, anyway.
I hope he had a few more people yesterday.
He wasn't there yesterday.
Oh.
Wasn't his day to watch him, as they say. So
he drew the short straw.
Yeah, he drew teardown day. So he's at the home show at the fairgrounds. So if you need a tractor of some kind, Kubota, John Deere, scurry down to the Shasta County Fairgrounds and say hi to Bill.
And don't let the rain stop you.
Yeah, no. Well, it actually wasn't raining a minute ago, but, you know.
Today's your last chance.
But we have climate change, right? So it'll change. That's what it means to me. One day it's raining, one day it's not. So we have a fun show today. We have two guests, two totally different topics, two wildly different topics. The first topic is about the campus rape frenzy, which was kind of fun. I was really excited to see that come through. Stephen Manfredi from the Manfredi Strategy Group there in Alexandria, Virginia, took a liking to us a long time ago. I've never actually met him, but he sends us these great guests. And so we get to learn all sorts of new things that we wouldn't normally come across. And the second hour will be about a new book called DC Confidential, Inside the Five Tricks of Washington. So.
There are only five?
Yeah, it's only five. No, I was kind of excited about that, too. I'm like, five we can beat. Any more than that, we're buried. This is a co-authored book. You have two people. We have one of the authors on. We have Casey Johnson on. He is a professor of history at Brooklyn College and CUNY Graduate Center, where he specializes in recent U.S. political, diplomatic, and legal matters. He's the co-author of The Campus Rape Frenzy. He authored it with Stuart Taylor Jr. And, he's done a whole, I'm sure he'll tell us about those, written for The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York, Daily Times. And so, been a busy bee. Do we have him connected in there?
We do.
I just dialed the phone. That was like the extent of my expertise. So I'm not sure what happens after that. So
I am here. Thank you for having me.
That is super. You sound just like you did when I talked to you on the phone a minute ago.
This is always good.
I know. Isn't that nice when we can get from like one part to the next? Oh my gosh. So. Okay, so what made you guys, besides the fact we keep seeing it in the news, but the book is titled The Campus Rape Frenzy, and it came, when did it come out? I kind of forgot to look.
It came out earlier this year in January.
Nice. So why did you guys, have you written books together before?
We had. So Stuart and I, around a decade ago, co-authored a book on the Duke LaCrosse case, which was this famous false rape claim involving three lacrosse players at Duke who were charged with rape. The case was prosecuted by an incredibly corrupt local prosecutor named Mike Nifong, who was essentially using the case to mobilize the black vote, which he needed to win election in Durham, and in which he got the strong support of the Duke faculty and the Duke administration.
Lovely.
And much of the national media, especially the New York Times. And so, you know, we covered the case extensively and then wrote a book about it. It ultimately collapsed when the evidence of the guy's innocence came out. The prosecutor was disbarred. He went to jail. Duke never really apologized or anything, but nonetheless, it moved along. And so, you know, so we wrote about that. And one of the things that we assumed from that book is that people would learn that when we're dealing with these campus claims, you have to avoid rushing to judgment. You need to have due process. You need to have a fair approach to how it's investigated and how it's considered. And so we had been following this as a general issue. And then in 2011, but we assumed we were never going to be writing about this topic again. And
sure.
We both moved on to other things. And then in 2011, the Obama administration changed the rules. So they reinterpreted Title IX, which is, you know, federal law banning sex discrimination in educational institutions, to give to the federal government authority over campus sexual assault questions, and to say that there's an epidemic of sexual assault on campus. This was the administration's claim, and so colleges and universities needed to adopt new procedures that all increased the chances of being found an accused student being found guilty. So you have a felony offense, you know, sexual assault, that is being tried within the college.
And it's, and so the only police you get to deal with are the campus police?
Oftentimes not even that, and that's really one of the shocking aspects about this.
The whole
accuser's rights movement in the campus context does not want police involvement of any type. And so these cases are normally investigated by the Title IX office within colleges and universities. So these are bureaucrats who are hired generally for their particular views on gender-related questions. So they're presuming guilt from the start.
Where all women are victims and all men are abusers.
Yes. Well, yeah. the preferred word on campus is survivors, not victims. And, you know, so the argument is you make an accusation, you're automatically a survivor. Well, if you're a survivor, the allegation is over. So it's this quasi-judicial system that exists only when one college student accuses a student from her own school of sexual assault. It doesn't apply to other felonies. And then it goes through one of these Title IX tribunals on campus.
So, and do they have any like actual forensic evidence? If these people are bureaucrats, do they have any expertise in that kind of thing?
They are trained. And one of the interesting, so this is one of the orders of the Obama administration, was all of these people have to be trained. And the equivalent would be in the criminal justice process. Imagine if in rape trials, all juries who handled rape cases had to be trained, and the only training that they were allowed to look at was training that was given by the prosecutor that would make it more likely that they would come up with a guilty finding. And that's essentially what this training is. It's, you know, it's sort of one-sided, and it doesn't really help. There's no forensic investigation. Colleges and universities don't have the legal authority to subpoena evidence. And so what they're doing is making these life-altering...
Oh, well, that tells you everything right there.
Right. On the basis of incomplete evidentiary basis. They're basically just guessing.
Wow. Wow. So if you're a young man in college right now, you better make sure you don't connect with some girl that, you know, is feeling hysterical. I mean, a lot of these, I would imagine, you know, I went to college, you know, a lot of these things are real, of course. I mean, we, you know, acknowledge some are real.
Absolutely.
But then there are the, I got drunk at a party last night and don't remember what I did.
Right.
And somebody must have done something bad to me, and it was probably you. And you can't get out from under that.
Right. The vast majority of the cases that we look at in the book, and you know, we looked at the files and read more than 100 cases and write about around 50 of these cases, are cases where, you know, it's a one-night hookup. Both the male and the female students were drinking, usually drinking to, you know, considerable excess.
Not in college.
Sometimes sometimes these allegations come months or even years after the incident, and so there's, you know, to the extent that there were witnesses, you know, generally, if you've been to a drunken party 18 months ago, and you know, you're not going to remember what went on with two other people who happened to be at the party. So, you know, it's a system where they're operating on very a weak evidentiary basis, and critically in the college context, you know, college students do use, you know, they text a lot, they use social media in a variety of ways, but colleges can't subpoena any of this. And so none of the relevant electronic evidence makes its way to any of these campus tribunals.
And when did this all begin? Under the Obama administration?
Yes. So the guidance came in April of 2011. And it's part of a general shift by Obama after the 2010 midterms, which, you know, as we all remember, you know, were a fiasco for the Democrats. But one state they did very well in was in Colorado. And in Colorado, they did well in part by appealing on social issues. And so if you think back to 2011, 2012, Obama starts embracing a whole bunch of left-leaning social issues. You know, marriage for same-sex couples, Dreamers, the contraceptive mandate as part of Obamacare. And this is part of that shift towards a more aggressive approach towards social issues. And in this case, the thinking seems to have been this will energize the feminist base in the run-up to the 2012 election. So you have a law that had been on the books for 39 years. Title IX is passed in 1972. And all of a sudden in 2011, out of the blue, this federal office in the Education Department called the Office for Civil Rights produces a letter which they sent to every college and university in the country saying, we have now decided that Title IX gives us the authority for you to, you have to use lower evidence, you have to discourage cross-examination, you have to give accusers the ability to appeal a not guilty finding in these campus tribunals. And if you don't do what we say, we'll pull all of your federal money from you. And so colleges and universities had no choice but to comply.
And so if you're accused and found guilty, do you get to appeal? Or is it only the girls get to appeal?
Both sides get to appeal.
Do you a lot of good, but
it will do you no good. I mean, generally the appeals go to the Title IX officer or someone else within the campus administration, and your chances of winning an appeal for the accused are very, very slim. You know, in part because administrators tend to be very sympathetic ideologically to accusers, but in part because administrators live in fear that if they find someone not guilty, they'll get a Title IX complaint against the school, and then the school will have to be investigated by the federal government, which costs lots of money and takes lots of time.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think I would want to have a young man in college right now, or be a young man in college. That sounds it is decidedly frightening. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Casey Johnson, who's co-author of the book, The Campus Rape Frenzy. And so before you send me hate mail, we get that this does happen, but in a lot of cases it doesn't. So we're going to talk about those today. So just so we know where we are going forward, you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Now that was a ball. You had some of the best times you'll never remember with me. Alcohol.
And that's where all the problems start. Shouldn't make fun, but we're going to, because that's what we do. Casey, so how many of these cases that you looked at, how many of these do you think the people were actually innocent?
We've looked at around 100 and between 100 and 120 cases, and in almost all of these cases, the guys were innocent. Now, these are cases in which there were lawsuits that were filed by the accused students who were wrongfully found guilty. There's no good data in terms of, you know, what percentage of claims are actually false. But there is a good study that was just out by a professor at UCLA that showed that if you're innocent, you know, in one of these tribunals, you have at least a 1 in 3 chance of being found guilty because of the standard that they use and the minimal protections that you have for your rights, which, you know, is a really frightening total.
And it isn't like this isn't a black mark like on your school record. This is literally a felony on your public police record. And then are you considered are you a sex offender if you attack
a
grown up?
See, that's the interesting thing about this. There is technically no law enforcement element here, although police are free to subpoena these records if they choose. What there is, though, so there's a black mark on your academic record.
Okay.
You're kicked out. And effectively, your life is permanently altered. So you put yourself in the position of one of these guys, again, who's not guilty but has been wrongfully found guilty. So you have a record saying, you know, you've been found guilty of sexual assault by your college. You're not going to be able to transfer schools because what school is going to take in someone who has been deemed a rapist? Any job that you're trying to get after, for the rest of your life that has a background check, you're not going to get that job either, because what employer in their right mind is going to hire someone who has been deemed a rapist by their institution? So these are life-altering effects outside of the criminal justice process. I mean, they don't need to register with the state or anything like this. But if you project this out, you know, these are decisions that are, you know, would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in earning capabilities, and you know, will be with these guys for the rest of their lives.
Jeez, Louise. So if you're a student or a parent of a student, your recourse is zero because this is happening at all schools in the country.
This is happening at all schools. There are a couple. The only way to avoid these tribunals is not to have any kind of sexual or romantic contact with a student from your own school. And in the real world, you know, there's just no way that's going to happen. The one area where accused students have enjoyed some success. Colleges don't want lawyers involved in these processes for understandable reasons, because the processes are kind of rigged. And in some instances, students who have been accused immediately hire a lawyer. The lawyer tries to go to court to try to get the process frozen or to force the universities to negotiate in some respects. But in general, once you're accused, you're in very, very dire straits.
Wow. So your Stephen had sent me, some information here. So I guess their studies say that 1 in 5 women is a victim of sexual assault. Is that what they're peddling?
Yes, this is what the Obama administration has promoted, and it's based on a 2007 survey of two of the more than 7,000 colleges and universities around in the country. And if you project that out, because they prefer to just use this 1 in 5 figure.
Mm-hmm.
That would mean that there are between 400,000 and 500,000 female undergraduates every year who are sexually assaulted on college campuses, but no one notices because the actual total seems to be around 5,000 at most per year. So the argument is that from the administration is that we have this epidemic that the typical college campus has a much, much higher rate of violent crime, because sexual assault is a violent crime, than anywhere else in the country. So, Detroit, Oakland, St. Louis, Baltimore, the cities that the FBI lists as the most dangerous cities in the country, they don't hold a candle in terms of violent crime to Cal Berkeley or Stanford or USC or UCLA, because according to the Obama administration, which is, of course, crazy. No one in their right mind would believe this. But then the kicker is that our campuses are this crime zone, but we do not want police involved here at all. We're going to handle this through Title IX bureaucrats, and they'll investigate, and they'll prosecute, and they'll conduct the tribunals. So it's a really absurd claim once you sort of dig down and look at it. But this is the argument that was presented, by Obama, accepted by most leading figures in California. Key law passed in California by Feinstein, by Boxer, by Kamala Harris, and by most in the media.
Jeez, I don't see any way to unwind this unless the federal government drops. What kind of a process will it be to unravel this, do you think?
It's a great question, and it's not going to be an easy process to unravel.
There are
a couple of ways that it may at least begin to get a little fairer. The first is that Obama issued a lot of, and it wasn't just on the campus sexual assault issue. Obama issued a lot of executive orders and guidance that went outside the bounds of usual governmental authority. So Trump or Betsy DeVos, the current education secretary, if they wanted, they could repeal this guidance tomorrow. Because the Obama guidance in 2011, and then there was supplementary guidance in 2014, didn't go through a notice and comment period. It wasn't issued as a formal federal regulation. It was just issued as a letter. So DeVos could write a letter tomorrow saying, we no longer are going to follow this guidance. That wouldn't get things fairer, but at least it would remove the federal pressure. The other thing is that lots of these cases have worked their way into the court system, and those really are the sources for the book. The one thing that people often don't understand is that when you think of a trial, one of the key checks in a trial is that it's occurring in the open. So if the prosecution is behaving corruptly, the media, the public can be in the courtroom and they can witness this this problem. Campus tribunals are always secret. There's no public involvement at all as a result of federal privacy law. And so these lawsuits are really the only way where we get inside these systems and see just how unfair they are. And so judges have to be aggressive in basically telling colleges and universities, you have to be fair when you're handling these issues, and if you're not, we're going to issue decisions on behalf of accused students. And there have been around 70 judicial decisions around the country in the last 5 years. Most of those have been won by accused students. But, you know, going to court takes years.
Right.
It's very expensive. And, you know, a system where your best chance of vindicating your innocence is a 2 or 3 or 4 year lawsuit is not a system that we would think of as a model system.
No. That's crazy. By then hopefully they're out of school.
Right.
Do the accusers in these ever recant?
Generally, no. One of the ways in which the campus environment is so different than the rest of the country, I mean, the issue of sexual assault and rape is one in which, in society as a whole, there are lots of reasons that rape victims do not want to come forward, and in which at least certain quarters of the broader culture really discourage rape victims from coming forward. But that's not the case on college campuses. There is the reverse is true almost. There's this relentless pressure from administrators, from sort of campus organizations that, you know, you'll be protected if you come forward and this sort of thing. And so accusers who come forward have this enormous support network on campus that they're able to receive. So very, very rarely do you see any kind of recantation, because if they did that, they would be discredited in the eyes of their new campus associates.
Wow. And how much of this, if not all, is supported by the, you know, kind of the hardcore feminist, I don't know, I mean, I would call them man-haters, because most of them are, but
right,
is that the crux of it?
It's a combination of ideologues and sort of kind of self-serving bureaucrats. There's a lot of money in this. Harvard, for instance, currently has 50 staffers, 50, devoted solely to the issue of Title IX and Title IX enforcement.
Wow.
So, you know, if your salary depends, and, you know, you figure most of these people are making $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year. If your salary depends on finding an epidemic of campus rapes, you're going to sure well find there's an epidemic of campus rapes. So there's a lot of careerism within this movement in higher education. Administration is the fastest area of growing area of employment on campuses, far faster than faculty or in other support staffs. And so you have this pernicious combination in many ways of ideologues, you know, people who believe that women just never lie about sexual assault, and so the goal has to be to set up a system that vindicates their claims, and then people whose jobs depend on this system that's been imposed over the last 5 or 6 years, and if there are changes, that means they're going to have to find, you know, other employment.
It's bad when you embed it in the system and it isn't about justice. It's really about covering your career.
Right.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, another reason we won't see it go away anytime soon. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I would love to hear some maybe examples of that you found, you know, while you guys were writing the book, some cases where you were just like, oh. And I'm curious where this happens, if there is any frequency to it. The South, the East, the West, you know, is it on public, you know what I mean? In the university system, or is it in public school or state schools? I'm curious about all that, how it pans out. All right, we'll be right back with our guest, J.C. Johnson, Casey Johnson, who is the author of The Campus Rape Frenzy. And you're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
time I've known you, I still don't know what you mean. The weekend at the college didn't turn out like you planned. The things that pass for knowledge I can't understand.
Are you reeling in the years, stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine? Are you reeling in the years, stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine?
Obviously, the musical challenges today have been overcome by Bob Martin. Nice overcoming, Bob.
Yeah, it was a bit of a challenge for this hour, at least.
I'm like, what are you going to play for music? Oh, my gosh. So, you're listening to the ever-irreverent We the People Radio, where political correctness is not allowed, obviously. And we wanted to thank our sponsor. We might as well throw them under the bus and confess our affiliation with Powerhouse Solar. Those guys were founded in 2003 by Bruce and Susan Blake. They've grown into the North State's premier solar company. Family began business out of a passion to help people reduce energy costs and protect the environment, and remains true to its core value of treating every customer with integrity, honesty, and care. They're very nice. And they're right up there in Shasta Lake, 530-275-5600 or powerhousesolar.com. There we go. I forgot that for now 35 minutes, but I just remembered that's Bill's part. Bill's not here today. It's hard when I have to be two people. So much pressure. All right. So our guest, Casey Johnson, author of The Campus Rape Frenzy, and I know we've heard some of this in the news and whatnot, but honestly, I didn't have any idea it was this bad. I didn't realize they rewrote all the rules of law as it applies on campuses and all that. So give us some examples. How bad does it get for some of these folks?
Sure. So the way to think of how the college system works is that essentially an accused student is presumed guilty and generally is denied the chance to prove his innocence. It's really not a pleasant process. So I'll give you one example, a case at Amherst College up in Massachusetts, where a male student is drinking. He was drinking very, very heavily, and he encounters his girlfriend's roommate in the common area of their dorm. The girlfriend is away for the weekend. And the roommate suggests that they go back to their room and have sex. And they do. It turns out that the roommate recognizes the guy was very, very drunk. The roommate recognizes immediately she's made a terrible mistake. And she's texting a friend of hers, this is on the night of the incident, saying, made a terrible mistake. We need to come up with a good lie, and she uses the phrase lie in her text to avoid this problem. But then she has other things on her mind. She has another male student coming over to her room to have sex with him later on that evening. And Amherst is a small college. People find out about what happened. She loses all of her friends. And she falls in with the campus victims' rights organization. And around 18 months later, she says that none of this happened the way it claimed on the text, that she was sexually assaulted.
Twice or once?
Right. And she, by student number one. And she files a complaint through Amherst. The college says, do you want to go to police? And she says, absolutely not, because, of course, if she went to police, the text messages would come out.
Right.
So she does she does her complaint. She is asked, do you have any relevant text messages about what happened that night? She says, no, nothing at all. And Amherst can't require her to turn it over. And so they hold a hearing. There are three Title IX-related bureaucrats at this hearing. She admits at the hearing that she did text that evening, but they don't ask her for the text. She does admit that she had someone come over to her room after the incident with the first guy, but says that it wasn't to have sex with them. It was to comfort her after she had been assaulted. So you have someone who was simply lying and whose own text from the night in question would show that she was lying.
Right.
But Amherst didn't have the text. So they find the guy guilty. They kick him out. A couple months later, he he is able to track down the text, incredibly with the help of his ex-girlfriend, who is, you know, who is just outraged at what's happened, turns the text over to Amherst. Amherst's response is, well, it's too late. We don't care about this evidence. And then their investigator in court says that even if she had these texts, it wouldn't matter because Amherst's investigation only was concerned with finding texts that would corroborate the accuser's story. That is, that they just wanted evidence that would show the guy was guilty, evidence that was that showed the guy was innocent they weren't interested in seeing.
And they actually said that in open court?
They said that in court, right.
Wow.
And the argument that the investigator made is that people often don't realize when they are instantly realize that they are sexually assaulted. So if they've written something from the night in question that talks about how they weren't sexually assaulted, which was the case here, that evidence is irrelevant because they can later change their minds, which is simply it's a crazy line of argument in this particular case where, you know, where the evidence was clear from the text as to what was going on. So the guy sued. This incident happened in 2014. In February, the judge in Massachusetts allowed the lawsuit to go forward. It's scheduled for trial sometime late next year. So this guy's life has been a hold for 4 years in a case where he was clearly innocent. And if anything, he was, according to Amherst policies, a victim of sexual assault because under Amherst policies, someone who is incapacitated, which he was because of his level of drinking, can't form consent. And the accuser claimed that she had initiated the sexual contact, but then later suggested she withdrew during the act. So it's a good case of showing how the college's inability to acquire relevant evidence leads to these guilty findings. It's the case at Ohio State. Guy is 4 months away from getting his MD. So he's, you know, he's done all of his medical school, background. He's, you know, he's in the hospital doing his final training, and he's accused of sexual assault. It turns out that he had slept with his accuser around a year before. 2 days before she accuses him, she has been informed by Ohio State that she's going to be kicked out because of bad grades. And so she goes to the Title IX office and tells the Title IX officer that 10 months before she had gone out to a bar with this guy and that he had sexually assaulted her, and that because she had been sexually assaulted, she says she demands an accommodation, and the accommodation is that she not be kicked out.
Well, that's a neat deal.
Right. Really, really good if you had her as your doctor.
Yeah, no kidding.
And she's granted the accommodation. The Title IX officer does not tell the hearing board at Ohio State that the accuser had made this allegation only 2 days after she had been told she was going to be kicked out, that, you know, that she had this powerful motive to lie. So the hearing board finds the guy guilty. They kick him out. He sues Ohio State. There's a hearing that's held in a federal court in Ohio, and three Ohio State administrators are asked, do you consider it to be your job to get the decision right? And all three of them won't answer yes to that question. There's one Ohio State administrator, and this is a public university, who is asked, if you are aware that a student is lying during these hearings, do you believe it's your obligation to come forward and say, you know, this person is lying? And the administrators, a victim's advocate, said no, that was not her job.
Wow. So getting to the truth is not one of the choices.
It's not. It is wholly secondary. The whole thrust of these systems is to ensure that the accusing student is treated with dignity and with respect, which of course any accusing student
well,
should
right.
be. But
unless they're lying, at which point we upend them and yeah.
Right. So Stuart and I started researching this book, you know, in 2012. We are not aware of a single case anywhere in the country where a college or university, there are some cases in the criminal justice system, where a college and university has filed a claim against an accusing student for making a false sexual assault allegation. So this is a system where there is no deterrent to false claims at all. And that, you know, that really is sort of what you see reflected in these sorts of cases where, you know, they're not interested in the truth. The truth is secondary to their motivations at best.
Was the accuser in the Duke rape case charged with making a false statement?
She was not. Although the Duke rape case was an interesting twist because the case went to the Attorney General of North Carolina, who conducted a comprehensive investigation, you know, made a public proclamation that the guys were innocent, and then said that he seriously he looked into the question of whether she should be filed with whether she should be charged with filing a false police report, and he gave two arguments as to why he didn't charge her, and I think he was probably correct in this. The first is that she was mentally imbalanced, and so, you know, that he would have to prove that she had an intent to lie, and she may be able to just have claimed that she was, you know, a lunatic. And then secondly, nice. He was worried that there would be public protests and wanted to avoid that. It turns out she's in jail now anyway because she murdered her her future boyfriend.
She really was a man hater.
To
the core.
She was convicted of arson for trying to after the rape case, she hooked up with some guy, tried to burn his apartment down. She was convicted of arson. Then she hooked up with another guy who she murdered, and she got a close to a 20-year sentence.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, I guess...
Why did she plead insanity?
She tried in that case, but that was rejected.
They were like, yeah, maybe not.
She only got 20 years?
It was a second-degree murder charge.
Jeez, well, we ought to watch out for her in the future.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, since I'm the only woman in the mix here, I just want to say this is embarrassing. You know, I mean, it's the wrong word, but I mean, this is just, it's horrible. There's no way that this should be, that we should be telling young women that this is appropriate or this is how women act or these are, like, rights that women should have or whatever the heck they're pushing. I mean, that's crazy. The rule of law is the rule of law. Right is still right. Wrong is still wrong. You don't get to just, I'm a woman, so, you know, I don't understand how that creates any kind of equality. And so, right. I'm sorry, I don't expect you to answer that, but I just hate this feminist thing. Okay, so what kind of punishment can these courts do? Oh, I guess we have to take a break, but we'll wait a minute. What kind of punishment these little tribunals on the campus do they get to put people in jail?
They expel. So that's the extent of their punishment.
And
this is a critical but. All of these records can be subpoenaed by the police. So the worst case scenario is that this serves as a way of getting around Miranda warnings and other constitutional protections for accused students. But in most of these cases, it simply it leads to expulsion. And then the permanent branding on their educational record of these students as committed sexual assault.
So if you you're a young guy, this happens to you when you're in college, you get expelled, you go to apply for a job. Do you have to say that you've been arrested? Does this count as? This seems
is going to require you to turn over your transcript. And the transcript is going to have some kind of indication that you've been found culpable for sexual assault, and your chances of getting that job are going to go out the window. So essentially, for students who are found guilty in these tribunals, their employment options are limited to places that do not have background checks or do not require you to supply your transcript as part of your job application.
So, President of the United States.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So Obama could, you know, set the precedent there. When we come back, I'm really curious to know why you think that our colleges and universities feel that it's a good idea to teach students or to model for students, however you want to do it, that civil liberties don't count. that's a zero-sum game. If you're a girl, you win. If you're a guy, you get kicked out. You can blame anybody for anything, and it's nuts. Makes me angry. I'm going to take 2 minutes of anger management. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We have all the information about Casey Johnson and his book, The Campus Rape Frenzy.
Some people run from a possible fight. Some people figure they can never win. And although this is a fight I can lose, the accused is an innocent man.
There you go, Casey. If you ever decide to do your book as a musical, you can use that as your as your intro song.
Right.
So colleges, they're making safe spaces. It's like preschool, except the consequences are huge, especially on a thing like this.
Right.
So nobody has to own up to their own behavior. Nobody has to follow the rules. Laws don't count, and they're living literally in a bizarre, twisted bubble that has nothing to do with reality.
Right.
What the heck? I know because we've interviewed some of them. There are some students that are like, I just got to get this piece of paper and get the heck out of here. I've got a bunch of nieces and nephews who managed to squeak through, you know, just like, get there, get the degree, get out.
Right.
Why are we not teaching our up-and-coming adults that civil liberties matter?
I think part of it is that you have at most campuses, and there's an important gap on this issue between elite schools, Ivy League, elite liberal arts colleges, prominent research universities, areas where the faculty in particular is very involved in setting campus culture, and the rest of the colleges and universities. And at the upper tier schools in particular, there's this sense that the United States is a society that's deeply sexist and racist and classist, it's an oppressive society, and that it's the job of colleges and universities to undo that depression, that students come in not recognizing that they're part of the oppressive society. And so things, basic civil liberties like the First Amendment or due process protections are instruments of the patriarchy and are instruments of power that need to be subordinated. It's a very frightening attitude towards foundational American principles. We've seen a lot in these campus protests where the argument is that free speech needs to be subordinated to the creation of these safe zones on campus where students are not, where we make sure that students don't hear anything that might in any way offend them. And this movement on due process issues is it flows from that same impulse that students, especially in this case female students, are weak, that they need to be protected, and that the college needs to sort of walk them through and inform them that they're victims of sexual assault. Because part of the underpinnings here is that students, female students, don't realize when they're sexually assaulted.
Right.
They need lots of education by the colleges to let them know these things. So it's a paternalistic movement, but the idea is that the guidelines need to be set by these administrators and by certain kinds of left-leaning faculty on identity politics issues.
Well, it's pathetic because at the end of the day, these people wouldn't make it 5 miles on the Oregon Trail.
Right, right.
I mean, if we, that's always our standard, you know, how many miles, you know, we actually at work, you know, kind of hold up the fingers, like how many miles would they have made it?
Right.
I mean, that's just, it's sad. We're talking about empowerment and they want equal pay for equal work. Well, they can't do equal work because we're teaching them to be complete idiots.
Right, right. Yeah, they're not learning important lessons. I mean, they're learning.
Well, they're not dealing
really
with reality. Can you imagine hiring one of these people?
Yeah, they're being taught that civil liberties are bad. And
right.
That's a frightening lesson to learn.
That they should be able to stomp their little feet and recreate reality, and that makes it real. And then they go out in the real world. Imagine what a shock it's going to be the first time they go to an office and somebody says, yeah, it doesn't work that way here. Oh, my gosh. You have to do a secondary book. You know, the reality check. I bet it's shocking for them when they go out and try to get jobs. And I bet most of them are going to be unemployed.
They'll be so triggered.
Yeah. The triggering will be huge.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Well, well, I'm going to be mad all day now. Hope you're happy. So, Casey Johnson and your book with Stuart Taylor, The Campus Rape Frenzy, sounds like a must read because apparently our civilization is almost over.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks a million. You can find all the information about the book, the authors, and everything else. We'll be here at second hour as well at wethepeopleradio.us.